Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
One in two women wear the wrong foundation. Are you? Time to upgrade. Il Makiage is the boldest new brand in beauty. With 20,000 five-star reviews, their Woke Up Like This foundation is a bestseller for a reason. Available in 50 shades of flawless natural coverage, all cruelty-free. And with Try Before You Buy, it's risk-free. Take the Power Match quiz to find your perfect shade and try it free for 14 days. Go to ilmakiage.com/quiz. That's ilmakiage.com/quiz.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 13th of January, these are our main stories. Protests continue in Iran after the government admitted the military shot down a Ukrainian passenger plane. Ethiopia, Egypt and Sudan negotiate the future of Africa's biggest hydropower dam. Spain's first coalition government in 80 years lays out its strategy. Also in this podcast, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison admits he could have acted differently as bushfires rage across the country.
You know, there are things that I could have handled on the ground much better. These are very raw, emotional environments.
And thousands of Canadians are told there's a nuclear incident near their homes, a warning that turned out not to be what it seemed. There's been a second day of protests in Iran after the authorities admitted the military shot down the Ukrainian passenger plane last week, killing all 176 people on board, many of them Iranian. Hundreds of students gathered in central Tehran chanting slogans, denouncing Iranian leaders as liars. There was also a pro-government demonstration in front of the British Embassy in Tehran, with protesters calling for it to be closed. Our correspondent Caroline Hawley has been following events from Beirut.
What we know is that there have been protests in many cities. We know that absolute fury is being expressed. There are chants that the top leadership must go. And in one place they were chanting, they're lying when they say our enemy is America, our enemy is right here. So really challenging what's almost a sacred dogma of the Islamic Republic, that America is the enemy. And one very interesting video posted on social media shows Iranian students who are protesting, and they're carefully avoiding stepping on huge American and Israeli flags that have been painted on the ground at their university. And then a few people do tread on them, and they shout at them very angrily for doing so. So the legitimacy of the regime is really being questioned, but it's hard to say just how widespread and just how big these protests are and what will happen to them.
What do you make of this apology from the commander of the Revolutionary Guards, Hossein Salami, apologising profusely for the downing of the jet? Are people taking that seriously, and how does that change the balance of power within Iran?
Look, he's not the first to apologise. Yesterday, when Iran finally came clean after 3 days of denials, regime officials, senior officials were falling over themselves to apologise. They said lessons would be learnt. But as far as I'm aware, no resignations have been made, and there have been no sackings. And certainly what the regime has done so far has not been enough to assuage this very, very deep anger at what's happened.
What's happening with the Iranian investigation into the shooting down of this passenger plane? They've given visas to 11 Canadian officials. Does that mean that they really are opening up the investigation to proper outside scrutiny?
I think it's too early to say, but it's a very good question. We know that 8 more visas have been issued to Canadian officials. We know that a rapid deployment team, that's what it's been called, of Canadian officials arrived on Saturday. The new team is expected to go tomorrow. It's interesting because Canada, of course, doesn't have any diplomatic ties with Iran. So it does look there as if the regime wants to be seen to be cooperating. There are also 45 Ukrainians on the ground. There's been no more mention of the black box that was talked about on Friday when the head of the Civil Aviation Authority said it would take 1 to 2 months to analyse the data. We really don't know how the investigation is going to proceed. But as Western officials have echoed one after the other, the world is watching how the Iranians do this.
Caroline Hawley. There have been no official resignations or sackings over the shooting down of the passenger plane, but in the Iranian parliament, the head of the Revolutionary Guard, Hossein Salami, offered his apologies.
A number of our countrymen were martyred as a result of our mistake, but it was unintentional and we apologise and we are ashamed. I swear to God that they were our families, they were our children, they were our mothers, our fathers and our brothers. I have never been so ashamed in my life, never.
Both Iran and the US are still talking of the need for de-escalation, and the Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said there was a need for dialogue from all parties. In the US, the Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, told the CBS network that President Trump was still willing to talk to Iranian leaders.
What we've said, I've said publicly, the president certainly has said, is we will meet with them. We're willing to sit down and discuss without precondition a new way forward, a series of steps by which Iran becomes a more normal country.
America's Defense Secretary Mark Esper. Other stories now, and ministers from Ethiopia, Egypt and Sudan will hold talks on Monday to decide the future of Africa's biggest hydropower dam. The Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam has been a source of tension since Ethiopia started the project in 2011. Egypt relies on the Nile for about 90% of its irrigation and drinking water and fears the dam could lead to severe water and food insecurity. The BBC's Emmanuel Igunza reports.
The world's longest river is at the center of a diplomatic row that some fear could erupt into a full-blown war among countries that share its waters. The mighty River Nile flows through 11 African countries, including Egypt, Ethiopia and Sudan, which are now locked in a dispute over the construction of a mega dam on the course of the river. Egypt depends almost entirely on the river for its water and fears its people could be at risk once the $4 billion dam is completed by the end of this year. Ethiopia, on the other hand, says it has a sovereign right to exploit the waters of the Nile and sees it as crucial for its economic development. Four rounds of talks have failed to reach a consensus, with the two sides blaming each other. Seleshi Bekele is Ethiopia's water and irrigation minister.
We shoulder big responsibility. Yeah, this
Egypt came up with new proposals and a schedule suggesting that the dam be filled within 12 to 21 years. This is not acceptable in any circumstances. We just don't accept it.
At the heart of the dispute is the amount of water to be released from the dam to downstream countries like Egypt, which wants Ethiopia to guarantee it will not interfere with the river's flow, particularly during drought seasons.
Shukran, Your Excellency. My question regards the construction.
Despite the disagreements and the collapse of the latest talks, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi is confident that a deal will be reached this week and allayed any fears of going to war with Ethiopia.
We plan to reach an agreement by the 15th of January. Otherwise, we will continue the negotiations with the help of a fourth party that can facilitate the issue. You asked me about the remarks of our friend and brother in Ethiopia, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, who said he would assemble 1 million soldiers to protect the dam. We don't need to do so with each other. We should rather build and develop our countries, not to disagree and warn each other. Look, I'll tell you something. Egypt has not spoken offensively about this issue, at least during my tenure. We have never talked about our military capabilities or said that we can do so and so. We must find a common ground. This is how to resolve the issue away from any other form.
The US and the World Bank have played a key role in bringing the three countries back to the negotiation table when talks collapsed. Negotiators from the three countries have even met U.S. President Donald Trump, whose administration believes a deal is possible. Dr. Hassan Kambenji is a Horn of Africa analyst.
If both parties, for instance, can come to some compromise and meet each other halfway, there's going to be progress. You know, failure to do that, I think, is going to be increasingly difficult, especially for Ethiopia to accept, given the amount of resources they've invested in building the dam. Given that Egypt relies heavily, almost exclusively, on the Nile waters for its survival, I think they're trying to advance the national interest. But number two, it's also a negotiating strategy, because you have to start from a point that is a little bit farther than actually where you want to be for you to get to where you want to go.
The meeting in Washington is not only crucial for the three countries in dispute. They will no doubt shape the future of how countries that share the Nile waters can benefit from this powerful resource.
Emmanuel Igunza. Dialogue will be key for Spain's new left-wing coalition government. That's the pledge of the country's Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez. In a televised address to the nation, Mr. Sanchez outlined the aims of his government.
Es un gobierno plural, es un gobierno de coalición.
It's a pluralistic government and it's a coalition, but with a firm purpose of unity. It's a government that's going to be nourished by plural ideas, but which is also going to walk in a single direction. It will speak with several voices, but always with the same words.
The alliance between Mr. Sanchez's socialists and the left-wing Podemos party is the first coalition government in Spain since the 1930s. Our reporter in Madrid, Guy Hedgeco, told me more.
The economy certainly is a priority for Pedro Sanchez, not so much necessarily because of the performance of the Spanish economy, which has been doing relatively well over the last year or two, but more because there have been some concerns expressed in the EU and the business community about the fact that this is a coalition between the socialists and a party to its left, that party you mentioned, Podemos, which is quite on the hard left, some see it as, and that could lead to policies which are not business friendly. So I think Sanchez has been very keen to show that this is a government that's going to be a safe pair of hands when it comes to the economy. And of course, the other big priority for him is going to be the issue of Catalonia, trying to resolve those tensions between the northeastern region and the pro-independence government of Catalonia and Madrid. And that's an issue which has been dominating politics in Spain really for the last two or three years. And he really does want to try and get to grips with that.
And he only secured the backing of Parliament to form this government by the narrowest of margins.
Yes, that's right. He won that investiture vote on Tuesday by a margin of 2 votes. Now, that, I think, reflects how potentially unstable this legislature could be. He needed the votes of a number of different smaller parties, including one party which is a Catalan pro-independence group. Now, they, for example, are going to be watching how he performs very closely over the coming months, as will many of the other parties which supported him on Tuesday. So there's going to be a lot of pressure on Mr. Sanchez from different directions to see if he can give all these parties what they wanted in exchange for the votes they gave him last week.
Guy Hedgeco in Madrid. Coming up in this podcast, a new president in Taiwan raises hopes of a distancing from China.
They're hoping that their democratic institutions over the long term will win and that China might change. And it's very hard to say right now who's going to win.
And Haiti marks 10 years since a deadly earthquake devastated the country. China says it will not change its position that Taiwan is a Chinese territory after a landslide election victory by President Tsai Ing-wen, who rejects China's demand for reunification with the mainland. Responding to the election, the Chinese foreign ministry said the basic fact is there is only one China in the world and Taiwan being part of China will not change. My colleague Paul Henley spoke to two experts on Taiwan-China relations. Margaret Lewis is a law professor at Seton Hall University in the US, and Karen von Hippel is the Director General of the International Defence and Security think tank RUSI here in London. He began by asking Ms. Lewis whether President Tsai will be able to distance Taiwan from Beijing.
Well, there's already been a distancing, and certainly the first 4 years of Tsai's time in office, we've seen a cooling in relations compared with the Ma Ying-jeou era, her predecessor. However, you know, that's not just because of changes in Taiwan. In fact, I think there's been much more drastic changes in what has happened in Beijing since the Ma Ying-jeou time. Xi Jinping is a very different leader than what we had 10 years ago.
There was a lot of attention on Hong Kong, and a lot of Taiwanese were thinking what happened there could very soon happen to us, weren't they?
Well, and one thing that was really interesting to watch at the rallies and other times in Taiwan is that you actually see the Hong Kong protest flags being flown here, and people have come over from Hong Kong, even though they could not vote, to be a part of the celebration around this free and fair election. So certainly Hong Kong, the protests and the erosion of civil and political rights was at the forefront of voters' minds.
Thank you very much, Margaret Lewis in Taipei. I believe, Karen, you've met the president, is that right?
Yes, I've been to Taiwan a couple of times in the last few years. We do some work on at RUSI, but it's been fascinating for me to see some changes. And as you were saying, the relationship with China is incredibly complicated there. One thing that's, it sounds a bit trite, but both China and Taiwan are playing the long game with each other. So China is slowly strangling Taiwan and trying to block diplomatic recognition by even very, very small countries that most people haven't heard of. They, you know, get upset at companies like Delta Airlines or Hollywood Films or others who misrepresent the name of Taiwan. They don't like, I think, Republic of China, or I can't remember the terminology, but the Chinese government gets upset and so puts tons of pressure on companies when they do that, which to me is a sign of insecurity. On the Taiwan side, they're hoping that their democratic institutions over the long term, you know, will win and that China might change. And it's very hard to say right now who's going to win.
The BBC's Paul Henley speaking to Margaret Lewis and Karen von Hippel. Bushfires in Australia have killed at least 28 people since September. Thousands more have been driven from their homes. And now, as the fires continue to ravage the country, Prime Minister Scott Morrison has admitted that he could have done a better job of handling the crisis. Here he is speaking to David Spears of Australia's ABC News.
You know, there are things that I could have handled on the ground much better. These are very raw emotional environments.
Like,
I've got
what?
To say
like
that
what?
95% or thereabouts of the responses I've had in these cases have been very positive and very appreciative. But David, these are sensitive environments. They're very emotional environments. Prime Ministers are flesh and blood too, and how they engage with people. But the most important thing is the action we have now taken and the steps we are now taking to recovery.
Thousands of people who've had to evacuate their homes are still living in temporary accommodation. Our reporter Katie Watson has been speaking to some of them in the state of Victoria.
At the showground and cricket stadium in Wangaratta, there are a few residents who've just moved in. Dozens of chickens who belong to families who've evacuated from communities in the path of bushfires.
In the middle of the showground, a campsite's been set up. There are tents, caravans with awnings out and families sitting under them there, protecting them from the strong summer sun. Now, many people here have brought their dogs too. This is a pet-friendly evacuation centre and people can stay here as long as they like until they feel safe to return home.
They're holding a meeting to tell people what the latest is with bushfires, handing out maps of where the blazes are and where they're headed.
I'm just going to give you a very brief
Everyone listening intently, waiting to learn if they can go home safely. The support here for the authorities is appreciated.
There is a huge amount of fear in the community, not just around what has already happened, but what the rest of the fire season looks like.
Jamie Chubb is the Director of Community Wellbeing in Wangaratta. The city has helped these and thousands of other evacuees in the past week or so of intense bushfires. Jamie says Australians have been resilient.
Generally, we tend to take things in our stride. We are pretty laid back on most things. However, we also recognise just how severe bushfires can be. So we are certainly not naive in terms of what this impact could be on our communities.
Now, a lot of people obviously want to defend their own homes, they want to look after themselves, but how does that work with the dynamic in a community? Is it, you know, every man for themselves, or is it actually we all need to get out of this?
Yeah, so it's a bit of both. We have some people who leave very early. They recognise they can't defend their properties and they choose to leave. We also have others who will stay right until the fire hits their home and they will defend their properties. I think the important thing to recognise for our communities is that most of the firefighters are actually volunteers. So they stay and they defend their own communities and they look after each other and defend their own properties. What we're seeing in Australia at the moment, though, is that our volunteer resources are so thinly spread because we have fires everywhere.
And this is Nelly.
Across the camping ground, I meet musician Rudy with his sheepdog. He says the community spirit has been awesome, less so the political reaction.
We're always looking for someone to blame. So I think politically this is not a great thing for whoever's in power.
Do you think Australia's changed or Australians have changed because of this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think individually we've changed because you review things in your life when you have this kind of catastrophe. But also we are becoming more aware of things like global warming and stuff and you know, climate change and those sort of things. So I think in a way it's not a good thing, but at least we've become more aware of worldwide what's happening.
But for most people, now isn't the time for politics. As the evacuated families tuck into a potato curry kindly cooked by the Sikh community in Melbourne, the focus is on getting back to normal life as quickly as possible.
Katie Watson. It's been 10 years since Haiti was devastated by an earthquake which killed more than 200,000 people in the Caribbean country. On Sunday, thousands of Haitians attended memorial services to mark this sombre anniversary. Richard Howells reports.
The earthquake lasted about 35 seconds, but one local economist said Haiti had lost a decade because of it. The capital, Port-au-Prince, has not been rebuilt. 60% of Haiti's healthcare system is still destroyed. Amid the grief for victims, many people complain about the failed reconstruction projects, continuing political instability and violent criminal gangs. There was a small anti-government protest when President Jovenel Moïse laid a wreath at a memorial to victims of the quake where thousands are buried in mass graves, his appearance a reminder of the deep resentment felt by many ordinary Haitians over the government's failings.
Richard Howells. The Queen and senior members of the royal family will meet at Sandringham in the east of England on Monday to discuss the future role of the Duke and Duchess of Sussex. Prince Harry and Meghan surprised Buckingham Palace when they announced 4 days ago that they planned to step back from their royal duties. Here's our royal correspondent, Johnny Diamond.
Together in one room, with Meghan likely to be on the phone from Canada, the most senior members of the royal family will try to thrash out a way forward. Since Wednesday, when Harry and Meghan declared that they want to step back from being senior royals, spend much more time in North America and become financially independent, palace and household staff have been trying to work out a way that that could become reality. Officials say that the family will be presented with a range of possibilities. A fair amount depends on how Harry and Meghan see their royal role and how many royal duties they think they'll carry out. On that question hangs issues of funding and organisation. The Queen is still driving this process forward. She remains keen to see a solution within days. After the shock at Wednesday's announcement, there appears to be a sense of coming together to reach a solution. One official spoke of genuine agreement and understanding between the parties. But there are significant challenges ahead, unpicking the relationship as it stands and building a new one from scratch.
Johnny Diamond. Now, there's been plenty of speculation that Harry and Meghan are trying to escape the scrutiny of the British press. Kehinde Andrews is Professor of Black Studies at Birmingham City University here in the UK. He told the BBC that Meghan seems to have been targeted more than the other royals, specifically because she is a black woman who joined a historically white institution.
She must be one of the most highly criticised people in public life. And this idea that their behaviour, I'm not sure what she's supposed to really have done. If you go back to 2016 when they were first dating, there was some really quite overtly racial coverage. I think the Daily Mail had a column that was almost straight out of Compton. Could the Queen get on with her mother because she's from this black ghetto? It's changed since then. With the wedding, it was all a bit more pro-happy and post-racial. But since the wedding, it's been really vindictive. And maybe nothing particularly racist, but the way she's been treated, I don't know what else you would put it down to. And really the idea here is that she doesn't fit. There's something wrong with her. She's too rude. She doesn't fit into what the royal family is. And so you don't necessarily have to say, look, I don't like you because you're a black woman. It becomes very obvious that if you're getting constant abuse about not fitting into this white institution, there are racial undertones to that. And I think most black Britons would agree with that. It's a conversation that we have all the time.
Kehinde Andrews of Birmingham City University.
Imagine being woken up by a text message warning of a possible nuclear incident near your home. That was the experience on Sunday for thousands of people in the Canadian province of Ontario, but all was not as it seemed. The BBC's Peter Goffin reports.
At around 7:30 a.m., thousands of people across the province of Ontario received an emergency alert from the government on their mobile phones. It said there had been an incident at the Pickering Nuclear Generating Station. And, while there had been no abnormal release of radioactivity, anyone living within 10 kilometers should, it said, stay tuned for further instructions. The warning caused widespread anxiety. The Pickering Power Plant sits just outside Toronto, Canada's largest city. More than 6 million people live in the region. But that worry turned to outrage when, 90 minutes later, the government sent a second message saying there is no nuclear situation. The previous alert was issued in error. Hundreds of local residents took to social media demanding that officials be held accountable for causing undue panic. "You had the entire province waking up in fear," one person wrote. Others have found the mistake reminiscent of an incident in the U.S. state of Hawaii in 2018, when locals were accidentally sent an alert saying incorrectly that a ballistic missile was on its way to strike the island. Canada's emergency alert system has been in place for less than 2 years. It's generally used to warn of inclement weather or missing child investigations. But it's already faced a raft of complaints, from people who say the messages don't provide enough information, to those who argue the overuse of alerts causes unnecessary worry. This latest incident, whatever the cause turns out to be, will only increase calls for the system to be refined or replaced.
Peter Goffin. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Today's sponsor is Carbonite. Protect your business from ransomware and other forms of data loss. If you're paying attention to the headlines, you've heard about ransomware, a computer virus that locks your files until you pay a ransom. But did you know that more and more businesses are under attack? The key to stopping ransomware is protecting yourself before you're attacked. With Carbonite, if your business becomes infected, you can recover clean files from their super secure servers. Best of all, you don't have to remember to upload files. Carbonite does it automatically. Try it free at carbonite.com/podcasts and receive 2 free months if you buy.